Joining me today is a founding member of the Institute for Health and Healing at the California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco. She started the guided imagery programs at CPMC in Marin General Hospital and has written a book titled Healing and Transformation Through Self-Guided Imagery. It's a pleasure to welcome Leslie Davenport to the program today.
Oh, thank you very much. Happy to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. And I'm a little bit embarrassed to say I don't know much about guided imagery. And for myself and for other folks that may be listening that really aren't sure about what it is, can you tell us a little bit, Leslie, about what guided imagery is?
Yes, it's a method of heightening our own self-awareness of the subtle workings of our body, of our mind, and of our emotions. Mm-hmm. And in the process of becoming more familiar with ourselves in this way, we also begin to see the links of how our thoughts affect our body, how our thoughts affect our emotions, and vice versa. And we can begin to then harness the healing potential that lies within by becoming more familiar mm-hmm. with how these things work together. And I'll say a little more. The part where imagery specifically comes into play is images are considered the language through which our mind affects our body. And let me try and put this in a little more concrete terms.
Please.
Just a really simple example is if you start thinking about a really tense, frustrating situation or person or someone that maybe makes you really angry, it's likely that your mind would start to recall pictures from that scene, what they look like, where you were the last time you saw them. And if you stay with that for even half a minute, you may start to notice that your body changes. Your muscle tension may shift. Your blood pressure may go up. If we had the right kinds of equipment, we would even see that your body chemistry started to change.
I grind my teeth.
Well, there you go.
when I think about those angry situations.
There's all kinds of ways. And in fact, we do it so much and so much of the time that we don't realize the impact. And that's what I'm saying about we're really tapping into a really remarkable way that people can participate and be much more empowered for their own health and healing as we become more aware of what we do that either works for it or against it.
An interesting concept that you brought up is conceptualizing a thought as a picture, which we do.
Yes.
When I think about my thoughts, I'm not usually like seeing words.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. I love to give this example, too, of how easy and natural this is. If I asked you, how many windows do you have in your home? You know, most people right away start picturing their home and they're walking in their mind, walking through the living room, glancing down the hall, peeking in the bedroom. Because unless you've recently remodeled, you don't have a number pop in your head. It's how we retrieve information.
And you initially mentioned, Leslie, awareness of these thoughts and subsequent feelings. It made me immediately think of mindfulness. And I'm wondering how guided imagery may be different or similar to mindfulness.
Yes, I would say that mindfulness and forms of meditation are sort of a cousin to imagery. In fact, they both have very long, old histories. So even though guided imagery is thought of as a more recent addition to medicine and psychology, it's been around for a long, long time. And it really is drawing upon a very natural part of us. So probably one way to look at the difference is that classical meditation, there's many forms, of course, teaches us how to let thoughts and images just pass by, sort of like birds flying through the sky. You know they're there, but you don't necessarily focus on them. You don't push them away. With imagery, we actually take something that comes into our field of awareness and then begin to explore it. And the exploration takes us deeper than maybe the surface associations, but it's a way of going into our thoughts and images to discover them more rather than just letting them pass. I would have to say, though, that in some ways the outcome ends up being the same in that We get less tangled and caught by our thoughts and images because our awareness comes to them, very similar to mindfulness.
Mm-hmm. One thing that came to my mind as you described this process is how sometimes in athletics or in sports, athletes working with therapists or psychologists will practice actually visualizing themselves scoring that goal, throwing that touchdown pass, or making the play. Is that something that would be considered under the realm of this sort of process?
Very much so.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that makes this so interesting is that in some of the studies done with functional MRIs, they're finding that the parts of the brain light up in the same way as if we're actually shooting that basketball hoop or for imagining doing it. So it's through the process of applying a focused concentration and that imagining that actually starts to train our neurological responses to be more accurate.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty amazing. And so in a similar way, you had mentioned a study related to surgery, and there are many other good ones as well. One of the tools is to imagining it going very well. And the body cooperating. And it's not just as simple as wishful thinking, but it's starting to get our body on board with what it's about to go through in a preparatory way that actually has an impact on the outcome.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that this has been around. Guided imagery is not something that's just appeared recently.
Yes.
Can you share a little bit about the history of how it developed? And you had mentioned earlier that some of the common conceptions or misconceptions about guided imagery maybe now or throughout its history?
Yes. Again, because imagery is based on awareness, it can go in pretty much any direction. As you've mentioned already, there's the application in medicine. There's the application in sports performance. You can certainly imagine how it would come into the arts. It's a very open, creative realm. It has its place in psychology. There's a lot of work, especially around phobias. If people are afraid to cross a bridge or afraid of a spider, there's a lot that can be done in the realm of imagery leading up to then the real life encounters.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say in some ways, just perhaps parallel to medicine, some of its early roots arose through spiritual traditions and religion. And, you know, that fundamental human curiosity about why are we here and how does this work and can we influence our life and our destiny and do things happen to us and what does it all mean is probably the most fundamental entryway into imagery.
And those questions have been around forever.
Forever. And then as the different disciplines have emerged, this kind of questioning and awareness just naturally would flow into the different areas.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned other applications, and at the top of the program we did mention surgery. What are some of the other indications or clinical situations that guided imagery might be effective or that you personally use guided imagery for?
Mm-hmm. Well, because my practice is within a hospital setting, many of them are related to health issues. So some other common ones that are also have some great research backing them are coping with the side effects of cancer treatment, working with pain, nausea, the anxiety of being in the treatment machine itself, insomnia, MRIs, and, you know, if we also open it up to the broad area of stress management, you know, there's a lot of studies out there that say something like 75 to 90% of primary care office visits are related to stress-related concerns, because imagery begins with learning how to use our breath, learning how to relax our body. And so stress management is sort of a built-in component of what imagery offers.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that you practice psychotherapy at the Institute. How did you come to develop your own practice of using guided imagery?
Mm-hmm. Boy, that's it's kind of a long story that takes me back to my own childhood and kind of goes back to the questions of why am I here and how does life work? Because I was a very curious child. Mm-hmm. But I'll start with the more professional aspect of it, which is prior to what I'm doing now, I was a professional modern and classical dancer. Wow. So I actually have a master's degree in dance as well. And what interested me about dance was less the entertainment side and more an exploration of if I let a quality or an emotion run through my body without editing it, what does my body want to do? Does it want to leap? Does it want to slump to the floor? Is it symmetrical, asymmetrical? So that the whole exploration of dance was very much about the mind-body connection for me. Mm-hmm. And when, for a number of reasons, I wanted to shift or expand that focus and decided to go back to school in psychology, the draw to health and healing and medicine really interested me because, again, of that mind-body link. So from the outside, it looks like a radically different career. I was running all around and jumping around for the first part of my life, and now I'm sitting in a chair listening. But the internal workings is really the same exploration coming through a different doorway.
Mm-hmm. All those experiences, including the dance, led up to you being who you are today and the way you see things and the way you practice. And I'm wondering, for someone who hasn't gone through this process like myself, can you just kind of walk me through like what it would be like if I went to try and utilize guided imagery, what sort of the process is?
Yes. So if you and I were meeting specifically for that, we'd take a little time clarifying specifically what it is you'd like to explore. And it might just be something as simple as wanting to relax more, or it might be a very, you know, particular concern that you'd like clarity about. Mm-hmm. And once we had an intention, then I would invite you to get comfortable. We have chairs that actually recline, mm-hmm. lights that dim. And I would guide you through some breath practices and also a progressive relaxation through your body. Mm-hmm. And again, this would be you doing it by describing pointers of how you can tune in and release the tension in your body more. Mm-hmm. Once that's happened, I may ask you to invite an image to form for an environment that would deepen these relaxing feelings. And it might be a place you know, it might be a place that just comes to mind, but the idea being that you'd be free of pressures or expectations, could really be yourself. And at this point in the process, what's happening is that this is a bit of a simplistic model, but it serves also, is that we've really started to shift from kind of the left side of the brain, the logical, analytical part that helps us through most of the day, gets us from here to there, kind of linear, to evoking more of the right function of the brain, which is more impressionistic, more intuitive, has more of an emotional landscape. And so what you would begin to get if we now, in this environment, revisited your original question is a fresh perspective that you couldn't glean from just the usual, let's make a list of pros and cons, let's, you know, think about it in the usual way. You have access to a part of your perception, a part of your mind that normally is dormant, mm-hmm. unless you engage in activities that would call that part forth. Mm-hmm. So I might ask you to have this really relaxing place and these relaxing feelings in your body. Ask if there seems to be a message here, something that you're being reminded of, something it wants you to know. Mm-hmm. And we sort of enter into this kind of symbolic place that's a little hard to talk about here because we're using the other side of our brain. But it's really moving into a different kind of dimension in a certain way.
Well, as you talk about it, I went to Poipu Beach on the island of Kauai as my place. And it made me think that, yes, indeed, when I'm on Poipu Beach in nothing but my swim trunks, my perspective on life, my responses to situations and relationships are different.
That is a perfect example. And then what we begin to explore is that while it's so easy to feel that there, it's not to have those perspectives is not actually dependent on that environment, that it's within you. So then how do we retrieve that and help you bring it into your life circumstances now?
That's the hard part, isn't it?
It is in a way, although, you know, again, people can do that within a half hour and they're like, wow. And so in a sense, that's a little clue that is actually quite accessible. Mm-hmm. But it does mean that you have to be willing to set aside the time or have sort of a practice of tapping into that part.
Yeah. It made me think of another thing that often in our world, in sort of the, I guess, the left-sided brain world we often have to live in to do our day-to-day activities and so forth, that sometimes we think, well, if you know, I had this amount of money, I could be happy. Or if I lived here, mm-hmm. I could be happy. Is it possible to have that feeling of happiness without the environment or things that we think it needs to happen for us to feel that happiness?
I'm a believer. I absolutely would say a big resounding yes. Mm-hmm. You know, and part of that is that our internal environment, again, our thoughts and feelings, often are affecting us more than our external environment. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. We think it's, you know, if only this circumstance would change, I'd be happy. But a lot of people, let's say it's at night, the house is quiet, everybody's asleep but you know, and maybe your mind's going on and on about worries about work or something unresolved. Well, your environment is completely peaceful. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not your environment that's keeping you awake, other than it might be your past or future environment anticipating where you're going to be tomorrow. But in fact, your actual living experience in the moment, what's around you, is not what's stressing you.
How do we do that? It just seems like such a daunting task to be able to retrain our mind in some ways to be able to conceptualize things in that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well,
we need to be really smart. You got to be like a genius to be able to do this.
Not at all. I guess if there was one message I wanted, you know, to really come across, is that this is an absolutely natural part of us. It's just that it is a little bit like swimming upstream, because in this culture and at this time, it's not a valued part. It's not one that's naturally in our education system, you know, in our day-to-day workings. If we were at a different time or in a different part of the world, it might be a different story. Mm-hmm. So it does mean applying ourselves, but it's absolutely available to everyone. And it's a little bit like, you know, if you got inspired by hearing music and you decided you wanted to play the piano or you wanted to take up a new sport, you have to invest that time. You know, you have to get out on the court and swing it back and forth and miss the ball a bunch of times before that fun and excitement starts to come into play and all that is second nature. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like that. We just have to put in the time up front, but then it becomes a way of being, a way of perceiving a part of ourselves that we know well. Mm-hmm. It's just like opening those doors.
It takes practice, mm-hmm. like a lot of things. You did mention that in our culture, it may be a little more difficult to mm-hmm. to try and reframe our mind in this manner, and I hope that helps listeners give them a little bit of break, you know, to when they think about, well, how hard it is. Is it just because I can't do it? Can you speak a little bit to what are some of the things in our culture or society that make it maybe a little more difficult than, let's say, if we were living in a mountain in Tibet or something like that?
Yeah, well, maybe a simple way of thinking about it is the continuum between doing and being. Because there's a lot of emphasis here on doing, on achievement, on success, on demonstrated ways that we show our competence, which equates to our fundamental value. But that's, you know, if we were on the mountain in Tibet, there might be more about the inherent value of being alive, mm-hmm. and the mystery and the wonder of that, and how to approach that with a kind of respect and reverence that doesn't take the playfulness or the joy or even the productivity out of it, but the whole container, the whole perspective is shifted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does seem like often we are driven to distraction, making it harder to appreciate some of those things that you mentioned, like, for instance, just being alive, just the wonder of being able to sit here right now in this moment and share this conversation with you.
Yep.
I wanted to mention or ask you a little bit about your book, Healing mm-hmm. and Transformation Through Self-Guided Imagery.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about what went into the process of writing this book and what readers might expect from it?
Yes. It's funny. It sort of grew out of a situation not too far from this one, where I was giving a talk at a conference and I was talking about the work at the hospital and giving examples of patients' actual imagery sessions and how it benefited them. And someone in the audience approached me afterward and said, "That is so interesting. And how do I do that? Oh, and by the way, I'm with a publishing company. Do you want to write a book?" And I probably wouldn't have gotten around to it other ways, honestly. But the whole push behind the book was to create kind of a map of how can someone tap into themselves in this way. So it's very much of a how-to. There's forms of imagery that follow a script. You know, you're walking along a beach and you hear the seagulls, and this isn't that kind of imagery. Mm-hmm. This is relaxing, quieting the mind, tuning in, noticing what arises, and then steps for how to explore it and to essentially glean wisdom from it. Mm-hmm. And so the book has a worksheet. It has chapters that address sort of common obstacles and how to move through those. It gives 12 vignettes of people that I've worked with. Several of them are health-related, but it also goes into things like relationship conflicts and stress around finances and how tapping in can free us in around those things as well.
Would someone who went out and picked up this book, would they be able to learn some of the fundamentals and practice guided imagery without the guidance of a experienced clinician?
I have to say yes. At least that was my goal.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I've done to help support that and supplement it is that on my website, I have a series of free MP3s. Mm. And it's mostly just to help people relax and get into that imagery space. And then it just provides the prompts to go in and ask your own questions and see what comes up.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do it without those MP3s. But again, I'm trying to bolster ways to make it very easy and accessible.
And if someone were to want a experienced clinician mm-hmm. in guided imagery, how could someone go about finding that?
Mm-hmm.
Or finding someone?
Yeah. Well, we at the Institute for Health and Healing where I work, there are several of us providing that. But if someone happened to hear about this and they're in a different part of the country, there's something called the Academy for Guided Imagery. They have a website, and they do a wonderful training program, and they have a directory of everyone they've certified. So you can put in a city or a zip code, I believe, and get a list of practitioners in that area.
Okay. Well, we have just a little bit of time, but I did want to ask you something that I thought was interesting from your bio. You became an ordained interfaith minister in 1984. I think that's wonderful. What led to you becoming a minister, and how has it affected and shaped your approach to health and healing?
Yes. Well, I guess I have to go back to that, you know, perspective we touched on a little earlier of the why are we here and how do we make meaning out of our experience. And that's sort of been my driving question for many years. And at first I thought I was going to do a traditional seminary, but for me personally, the restrictions around a particular denomination felt a little too limiting. Mm-hmm. So when I discovered one that really recognized the beauty of all the traditions and saw that it truly, if you go deeply enough into them, they're kind of saying the same thing, that gave me a lot of freedom to both explore for myself and support others who are looking to open up those questions too.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it's not a particular denomination. It's not Christianity per se.
No, we do something in terms of the worship service part of it. We do something that has an altar that has candles representing Hinduism, Buddhism, Zoroastrian, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Mm. And there's a sort of a last candle that the shorthand is, if we didn't mention you, but basically all of those who've held aloft the light of truth, whether known or unknown to this world. So very inclusive and very respectful of what each of the traditions offer, but taking, again, a more unifying approach that they really are there for the same purpose.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds wonderful. It sounds very, like you mentioned, very an accepting mm-hmm. sort of way, a sort of approach to spirituality. And I really appreciate you, Leslie, taking the time to join me today. I feel more relaxed just having sat here and spoken with you. Thank
it's
you very
been
much.
Delightful. Thank you.
For more information about guided imagery and Leslie Davenport's work, visit her website at lesliedavenport.com. That is all the time we have for this week. Tune in next week at the same time for more perspectives on health and online at mindandbodyradio.com. For Leslie Davenport, this is Dr. Winston signing off, wishing you a healthy mind and body.